This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning and welcome on this wonderful, chilly winter Canberra morning. It's so lovely to see so many of you here this morning. And it's an absolute treat this morning. All of our Landmark Women talks are always wonderful, but it's a particularly special presentation that we have today with Dr. Jennifer Gall, who will be speaking, and I'll introduce her shortly. But while we were getting ready, Jennifer was practicing and tuning, rather, her fiddle. So we're in for a little bit of a performance as well. So it should be a great morning. Now, absolutely. Is that better? Is that better, Liz? Okay. So the talk this morning will go for about 40 minutes, and then we'll open up to question and answer. And then you're all welcome to come down to the Friends Lounge and join us for light refreshments, morning tea, and to continue any conversations you might want to have with Dr. Gall. We do have another group coming in at 11, so unfortunately we do have a little bit of a squeeze this morning, which is unusual for us. We usually have a bit more of a leisurely time here in the theatre. So I just wanted to give you a bit of a rundown of that. My name is Katrina Vignando. I'm the acting manager in the development unit here at the National Museum of Australia. You would normally be dealing with Carice Flanagan, who heads up our Friends program, but she's not able to join us today. So it is my great pleasure then to introduce Dr. Jennifer Gall, who is our speaker today. So I'll just give you a little bit of an overview of her background so that you understand the context of her presentation for us today. Jennifer Gall is the Assistant Curator of Documents and Artefacts at the National Film and Sound Archive. She completed her doctorate at the ANU School of Music, where she is currently a visiting fellow. She researches the relationship between music and popular culture, with a focus on Australian traditional music and the music of hidden women musicians. She writes about music for the Canberra Times, so you may have read some of her articles, and she has written several books for the National Library of Australia. The most recent of these books is about Rose Patterson, Banjo Patterson's mum. So I look forward to that one. They say behind every great man is a wonderful woman. In this case, it's a wonderful mother. So I think that should be a great book to watch out for. It will be released in 2016. Today's talk, Jennifer will describe her current research project, which is called Listening to the Past, Music in Canberra's Historic Museums. The project is funded by the ACT Heritage Grant, and some of the outcomes of this project will include three recorded sound works for each of the historic houses, which are Mugga Mugga, Homestead and Lanyon Homestead, and Calthorpe's House. So that's Mugga Mugga Homestead, Lanyon Homestead and Calthorpe's House. So Jennifer will be using musical instruments that belong to each of those particular homes, and music from and she'll be working with sheet music from their collections, and oral histories and archival documentation, and that has formed the basis of her research, which will culminate in a number of lectures and recitals in each of those house museums. So something to look forward to, and Jennifer will give us more details about those. Lecture recitals at Lanyon Homestead and Mugga Mugga Homestead are also scheduled for this year, so keep an eye out for those. I'm sure they'll be very, very interesting. So having given you a very brief overview, I would now great pleasure to introduce Jennifer. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you for that very warm welcome, Katrina, and Joe for making me welcome. And there she is over there. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. I'd also formally like to thank the National Museum of Australia very much for inviting me here. And I'm here because of other Landmark Women, as all of us are, but in this case, Frances Baldwin is a contact to make this talk happen. but there are quite a few other women who will be acknowledged in the course of this talk. A little bit about my background before I talk about the project. My family moved from Melbourne to northern New South Wales when I was very young, and I grew up in Lismore, a country town with a rich musical history. I studied piano and violin and viola, performed with the youth orchestra and the town orchestra and vocal ensembles, along with my teachers and tutors from Queensland Conservatorium and University of New England. So it was a very communal sort of music beginning for me. I discovered that there was a long tradition of fine musicians learning music in the town and making stellar careers for themselves overseas, like the Chisholm sisters, who you'll see on this slide. I first came across these girls in a newspaper article in 1974, so they've been a bit of a research interest for me for many years, and just recently I gave a talk in Lismore to the Richmond River Historical Society. The mayor attended, and in true mayoral fashion, she had wonderful connections, and I've found some missing links. So that's just a little bit about where I've come from. So since that time, I've been interested in the connections between musicians and the outside world, bush musicians really, and how they've gone out and connected with the larger world. In 2007, I completed my doctorate at ANU, and my dissertation examined the history of Australian women's domestic music making. And in the course of my research, I investigated the role of music in the life of Georgiana McCrae, who some of you may know of. She was a writer. Her journals have been published. But she was also a very fine musician, and she lived in this little house on the Mornington Peninsula, and she left behind four very large volumes of handwritten music she copied from her father's music library at Gordon Castle. So this house museum has a fascinating history of the actual music books, her journals, which are linked to the music, and her piano, which still resides at the homestead. I thought, though, at the time that it was a great shame the piano is not in a playable condition. So that's been another thread through my investigations. In 2014, I was awarded funding under the auspices of the ACT Heritage Grants Program to recreate, perform and record a sampler of music that would have animated the three historic house museums in Canberra, using the sheet music belonging to the houses, oral history recordings, and instruments belonging to each home. Examples, where possible, played on the instruments belonging to each home, will illustrate the cultural tastes of the different classes and personalities of people who inhabited each property. In collaboration with ACT Museums and Historic Places, the piano at Mugga Mugga and the piano at Lanyon have been restored to a condition that renders the instruments playable while retaining the audible evidence of the age of the instruments. The Calthorpe's pianola is in wonderful condition, so that's quite happy. The violin at Mugga Mugga has already been restored for an earlier talk I gave, so that instrument is quite playable and has quite a lot of rustic character, I might say. The project has provided a catalyst to prioritise cataloguing the music collections and the repair of musical instruments in the houses, safeguarding these fragile objects for future generations. I'm hoping to secure future funding to curate a series of house concerts using the restored instruments and household music collections, and to commission new compositions in the next step of the project, to demonstrate that the music of the past is just as relevant today and it has a particular power. Motivation for the project came from personal experience of visiting many house museums in Australia and Europe, as I'm sure you have all done. These are usually silent, devoid of musical sound, even though many of these places preserve the musical instruments that were an integral part of family life. Musical choices tell us a lot about the people who lived in a home, the kind of music they chose to buy, the instruments they played, what they aspired to, and who they connected with. My talk will look at these connections between the lives of early ACT residents and oral histories, historical documentation, and the published music collections at each of the properties. Now, I think I'm right in saying I've spotted a member of the Calthorpes family in the audience. Would that be correct? So I'm relying on Dawn to say in a very loud voice if I get anything wrong, and I'm sure you will support her. Calthorpe's horse is... horse? There's a good start. Calthorpe's house is the newest of the house museums, built in 1927 and occupied by Harry Calthorpe, auctioneer and stock judge. His wife Della, their two small daughters, Del and Dawn, and they did grow up, they didn't stay small, and their maid Agnes, who moved to their new house in Redhill from Queanbeyan. The family lived together in the house until World War II, I can't read my own writing, when Del and Dawn married. In 1950, Harry, a World War I veteran, died at the age of 59. Mrs. Calthorpe lived in the house until just before her death in 1979. In 1984, the family arranged with the ACT government to acquire the house to be preserved as a house museum for future generations. The significance of the museum is that it remains intact with the household objects and furnishing much as they were left in 1979 after continuous occupation by the family. The house represents fashionable style and taste of the 1920s, and the design of the house with its passageways and hallways reflects the architect's intention to create separate physical and social areas. And music, of course, would have inhabited these regions in certain ways. Part of my investigation has been to experiment with how musical sound was generated in different precincts of the house and to investigate how sound and music would travel between zones. For example, testing how much might be heard in the living room and bedrooms if the maid was going about her duties, sort of humming her music, or what might drift down the hall if somebody was playing the pianola or the piano. I've been interested to try and record the sounds of household appliances that would have accompanied singing during household tasks and cooking. These recordings create a sense of how musical sounds would cross the physical household boundaries and their accompanying social distinctions so that musically interested listeners could absorb material from both sides of the class system. And I must say, it's a very simple class system here. The music makers at Calthorpe's house would have been the four family members. Both daughters played the piano, as did Della. The maid Agnes was also a musician in her way, after her Mary MacDonald, and the various tradesmen who visited the house regularly, butcher, baker, postman, iceman, tinkers, hawkers, greengrocer and grocer. Music was heard on the radio and the gramophone and played on the pianola. There are copious documents and interviews with Dawn, and so reconstruction of the musical life of the house, as far as the family is concerned, is relatively straightforward. The house repertoire comprises musical tuition books used by the girls and a large collection of popular songs, as well as a substantial collection of pianola rolls, which were a favourite part of the household music making. Dawn describes how she and her sister gave a concert soon after moving into the new house, using the sitting room as a stage and the dining room doors as the curtain between the stage and the audience seated in the dining room. The program includes piano solos, recitations, juggling, harmony singing, acrobats, and fairy dancing. Neighbours and relatives from the cast and the audience formed the cast and the audience. So this is from Dawn's recollection. Del sees to it that we have music of one sort or another, piano, gramophone, or pianola. Mother loves Moonlight Sonata or a Chopin waltz. I love Knee Deep in Daisies. Our theme song is Always. Pop gives renditions of songs he performed in his youth, excerpts from Our Miss Gibbs, Choo Chin Chow, The Cobblers, Prisoners, Veteran Songs. His voice is strong and rich. Pop says a song is a blessing and should be exercised with the same zest as magpies do. We all love the pianola rolls and can sing the entire Rosemary. Pianola roll without looking. We swoon on Shine On Harvest Moon. Del plays Trees and we try to harmonise the last bars. Pop and Mother show us how they vamp on the piano or dance to the Destiny Waltz. Mother is feather light on her feet. She can reverse like a top and tries to teach us how. Del finishes the day by playing and singing bird song at eventide. These are the serene Sundays we enjoy in the sitting room in the days before the wireless. That's from her memoir, Chortles, Chills and Chilblains. The Culthorpe's House sheet music collection substantiates these recollections, and many pieces of the music have the name of the person who played it written on the cover. I'll play you a little bit of the sounds that we've recorded. We did a sort of a mock-up sing-along to record with the piano being played by Sandy France and a group of willing volunteers so that it has a nice spontaneous feeling. Of moving things, I'll just have to shorten that one, sorry. And there you see the pianola in action. In contrast to the richly documented musical life of Calthorpe's House, documentation for Lanyon Homestead is based on oral history recordings and limited historical written documentation. John Lanyon and James Wright chose the location of Lanyon as the home station of their pastoral enterprise in 1835. John Lanyon returned to England in 1836, never to return, and William Wright joined his brother in that year. The pair benefited from the allocation of assigned convicts, and from 1836 to 42 had an average of about 35 labourers and a nursemaid to look after the 8 children who arrived after he married Mary Davis in 1838. They lived in a slab hut, and floods destroyed all evidence of these early structures. It was the Cunningham family who in 1848 took advantage of the foreclosure on the Wrights' land to step in and buy Lanyon. The Cunninghams achieved the prosperity denied the Wrights, and in the 1860 house completed at Lanyon was a dignified home built of mainly local materials, sharing a common wall with the original cottage. The furniture is described as being mainly up to date, but not high fashion. The Cunninghams had 60,000 sheep, and in keeping with this prosperity, they possessed a piano but no butler at Lanyon. It's a particular status. Up to 50 people worked at Lanyon in the last years of the 19th century, living in a self-contained community with workers' homes doubling as schoolrooms and post offices. Until 1905, when A.J. Cunningham, aged 58, married the musically gifted 24-year-old Louisa Lehman, there had been no toilets or bathrooms at Lanyon. Meals were cooked in the outside kitchen and transported across the courtyard. At this time, the new wing was built, comprising a new kitchen, pantry, staff sitting room, master bedroom, dressing room, bathroom, lavatory with septic tank, and an acetylene household gas system. In 1926, the Cunningham family sold Lanyon to Harry Osborne for his newly married son, and then in 1930, the property was sold to Sydney businessman T.A. Field and resumed by the Commonwealth in 1974. Like Calthorpe's, Lanyon was also preserved class distinctions in the architectural design of the house, although a much more elaborate system, and in the behaviour of the family members towards the farm workers and their families. As it turns out, some of the best evidence about the musical life of Lanyon is preserved in the interviews conducted by Susan Mary Withercombe with Helen Flint and Lily Brown, née Cregan, in 1988. Lily remembered the grand piano brought in 1905 for Louisa as a wedding present by Andrew Cunningham and the gift of an organ she made to the new church, St Edmund's Church of England at Thower, as well as her own family memories. So here's Lily to talk about her view of music.
He used to put the records on the old phonograph, and he'd love to walk out and lean on the fence and listen to it. And he'd stroll back in and put another one on and listen to that backwards, forwards. He enjoyed that.
Nellie Melber, of course.
They used to come and sing it. Wouldn't matter who they were, Dad would welcome them. They loved music. And they'd sing without any piano or anything to accompany them. They'd stand up and sing. We didn't sing, though. You know, rotten game, I think, too shy.
So gramophone records were a very important source of music as well, and they were often the trigger for people to learn music. People were very gifted in playing by ear. They didn't necessarily need to have the written music. So those records that Lily referred to were very important as a source for stimulating music making. This little sound clip is from Helen Flint, and she recalled the weekly dances in the new hall at Thower. The music was provided by local musicians on a fiddle, two accordions, and a piano played by Miss Una West.
We used to always walk over to the power tower dances. Did they have a lot? Oh, yes, they did. And they were beautiful dances. They had the Kosaril Bush music. And we would walk over to dance and then walk back. About 2 o'clock in the morning.
So I thought I'd just play you a little snippet of a dance tune of the time. Things that were very popular were dances like Varsovienas, Schottisches, the Lancers in quite a complicated set. I'll just play a little piece of a Varsovienna that was collected from a man called Charlie Batchelor, who's a bit of a folk hero. So there was no amplification. People had to not talk while the dancing was in process. So it's quite interesting. Playing at a woolshed dance here in Canberra, at one stage the PA system failed. So it was an education for all of us. People were used to making a lot of noise while they were dancing and talking, and they found that if they wanted to hear the music, there was none of that. So it's interesting. Thank you. So what was important was the rhythm, to keep the rhythm clear. Embellishments were not a priority. It was important to keep a beat. I hope I did. So While it is not easy to find a definitive record of the actual music played in the Lanyon homestead, there are good clues about the musical life of those who lived on the property. The next property I'm going to move to is Mugga Mugga. It's a property which has been the focus of my research to date. Originally, much of what is now Canberra was the estate of the Campbell family of Duntroon. They imported a Gaelic-speaking community of shepherds recruited from Scotland to work the estate. All the families who lived at Mugga Mugga were originally employees of the Duntroon estate. Music that would have wafted out from the shepherds' cottages would have come from the Scottish Highlands. The origins of music for the Curley family at Mugga Mugga began in Roscommon in Ireland in 1817, where Miss Curley's grandfather, Patrick Curley, was born. His wife, Mary Fahey, came from Ballinasloe, County Galway. With their five-year-old son, Thomas, they sailed from Liverpool on September the 28th, 1841, arriving on January the 18th, and sometime in 1842 they arrived at Duntroon. One of the shepherds was Mr. Sinclair, who would wander around the slopes of Mount Pleasant playing his bagpipes with a small boy of 6 years, Patrick Curley, following him, enjoying his strange sounds. In 1866, Patrick Curley, aged 13, was employed as a junior shepherd at Mugga Mugga, the first outstation at Duntroon, and he lived on a stone cottage, in a stone cottage built by Robert Campbell for his shepherd, Ewan Macpherson. It was about this time that he received his first violin, and when he was 17, so the story goes, acquired the violin that is in the museum now. Self-taught, he would play for hours after work for private home dances and parties. Patrick would ride for miles to play for dancers around the district. They danced the waltz, the quadrilles, the lances, the valse cotillion, the mazurka, the polka, the schottische and the Varsovienna. This cottage, built in the 1830s, was inhabited by a series of families who would have made music in the course of their daily lives, work songs, lullabies, songs for entertainment and to share with friends. Patrick married Annie Elizabeth in 1893, who was living on the Duntroon estate as well and working there, and they inhabited Mugga Mugga from 1913 to 1995. They had three daughters, Ada, Sylvia and Evelyn, and the musical life of the house recalibrated around the family. These lullabies and songs to sew to and a piano to learn on were the new regime with the family in the house. The radio and the gramophone were new additions to the music-making devices. Patrick taught himself the popular songs of the day and tunes to dance to by ear. His daughters remembered him fondly, seated on a stool in the kitchen playing Scottish and Irish tunes on the violin. By the 1920s, only Evelyn remained at home with her parents to manage the farm for them. Ada became a teacher and Sylvia took up a nursing career. Patrick died in 1936 and his wife in 1948. Really, in practical terms, from 1932 to 1995, Mugga Mugga was effectively managed by women. Later in life, Sylvia Curley succeeded in preserving Mugga Mugga for Canberrans as a fine example of our pioneering past. And I'll play you a little snippet of Sylvia. You'll see some photos of the Lanyon piano too as we get to that point. The Broadwood is just about to be returned to Lanyon, so it's very, very exciting. I should comment too. This is Chris Leslie, who I've been working with on the restoration process, who is the most extraordinarily patient man. He's had to rebuild parts for these old pianos, cannibalise wrecked pianos, and I can't sing his praises highly enough. He just is so sensitive to a very tight budget and also to understanding the importance of the sound. And he has a connection with the Lanyon piano because this piano wasn't the actual one in the house originally, but it is exactly the same model and year as the one that was there. But coincidentally, it came from a property in Sydney named Lanyon. And Chris's mother lived in that region. So that's interesting connections. This is a little treat, a little secret that was inside the piano. It's one of the craftsmen's name that is written in pencil on the soundboard inside the Broadwood. So these are the kind of hidden delights that you find when you're pulling apart pianos. That's its nameplate, very grand. And here we are at Mugga. That's the piano in situ. in a very, very beautiful little living room, tiny, tiny room restored with sort of 1920s decor, wallpaper that's been repaired where possible and matched where the damage from the years was too much. That's an up-close portrait of the piano. It was a budget piano. The keys are actually a very early form of plastic, which is really interesting. And it's just as well they were, because the piano has remained in situ for a lot of the renovation work that's taken place in the house. It hasn't been moved. And one might think that was not ideal, but in fact, I think it has been the saving of that piano. It hasn't been moved, so no major structural damage has occurred. It was always covered up and kept out of the bulk of the dust. But those plastic keys, even though they were kind of the discount version, are much more robust than ivory. That's the beginning of the restoration process, pulling off the panelling to construct a conservation clean. You can see in that photograph the silhouette of the fingers of the person who was working on that key. That is one of the keys pulled out of the piano. And in the process of dipping the plastic or pulling the key out of the plastication process, his hands or her hands, I think it would have been a male at that time, that ghostly imprint is there. Oh, and I'll play you a little bit. This is what the piano sounds like now. This was from a performance I did at Mugga Mugga for the National Trust Heritage Fair. Very soft sound. So that you'll hear the sound. The dampers are a very interesting construction, and so that also the touch is quite different to playing my piano at home. Or, you know, I'm sure a lot of you have pianos that have a deeper touch when you press the keys down. This one is kind of a restricted sound, but probably manufactured that way for use in small spaces. And this is certainly a small space, the living room of Mugga Mugga. So this is just a photograph of that little recital, and I'll play you Sylvia Curley. And the thing I love about this quote is she leaves instructions about what she wants to happen to the piano.
Thank you, Ken.
I got this far. It's the last one, but I've exploded it.
Not a problem.
Many years ago, and my mother purchased, I think it was a politician, Mr. Beale, was selling his goods in Chatham, and she purchased his set, and it was run by a car battery, off a car battery, and the table and everything's all there connected up. And so Father would listen to the music on 2CA and all the tunes, and this is in his retirement years, poor Father. And then he'd come across the piano, and Mother would hear him, she'd be up there cooking, and he'd try out, and in no time he'd be playing that tune. He was a musician, he was. And his violin is with me down there, and it's going to come out here. It's a beautiful old violin. And he used to be asked to go and play at all the dances and the places. And in the very early days, the governess of Duntroon would send for Patrick Curley, young Patrick Curley, come along and play the music for the Miss Campbells to and Mr. Campbells, the boys and girls to learn to dance. That's the early Campbells.
And when he's playing, what sort of music would he play?
The old-fashioned the quadrilles and the lances, something that you wouldn't dance to. You wouldn't know how to dance the quadrilles and lances now. No, all those old tunes. It still has a tune. I know, but I'd like to get it cleaned now.
And we've cleaned it out.
Yay!
So what value does listening to the past or performing the past have for people living now? Here I draw on support from a nice new book that I've just come across called Sounds of Modern History. And it's very convenient when somebody comes up with a theoretical basis for what one feels in one's heart is the right thing to do. This is Mark Smith writing in an article, Futures of Hearing Pasts. To their credit, museum curators and curators of historical homes are increasingly, it seems, turning to historians of the senses for advice about how best to incorporate the senses onto their spaces and into their spaces. The most thoughtful curators are anxious to historicise the senses so that visitors get a sense not only of the sound of the late 19th century, but what they meant to people at the time. Rather than simply feeding sounds to ears, we need to help visitors understand the context in which those sounds were produced and how their reproduction can tell us not only about the nature of the past, but about our own intellectual preferences and prejudices. I believe that music has the power to unlock important truths about life in the past by connecting with our thoughts and emotions in the present. By engaging with historical instruments in their home environments, we activate a powerful creative energy that helps us make sense of the world. If we keep the historic house museum instruments playing with old and newly composed music, we better connect with others and feel more alive ourselves. And I'd like to leave you with an Irish air. It's called an Ailing air, which is a tune, very, very old tune. It's often played at funerals, but it looks to the next world, a kind of an ideal realm. And I think it was a very important tune for people who came here, who carried a sense of home. So I'll play you that, and I'll play it on my violin. It was given to me by an elderly woman who lived in Queanbeyan, so my violin's done a bit of a round of the world and come back home. It's called Tam Siam Clodagh. And I believe we have time for questions.
That was fabulous. Thank you so much, Jennifer. What a treat. How fabulous was that? Thank you. Now, as Jennifer said, we do have some time for questions. So if you'd like to put up your hand, we'll come to you with a mic.
Thank you, Jennifer, for your lovely talk and your sensitivity with how you speak about these beautiful homesteads around us. I very much enjoyed the sensitivity with which you played a violin and the mood and the personality of a violin. It's almost as part of your personality was in the instrument. And I just wondered, what age were you when you started to play the violin?
I came to the violin reasonably late, I suppose. I started with the piano. I played the piano from the age of about eight. I didn't have... There wasn't a violin in the home, although I discovered that my grandmother was a violinist. She was a governess on the Coorong, and she came from Ireland, but she played... You know, she was classically trained with piano and violin. But that was nice. That only came out after I took up the violin and my father remembered and said, oh, yes, my mother used to play. But so I was 14. I started playing the viola, first of all, which is the larger instrument, because growing up in the country, what they needed in the orchestras were violas, not violins. They had enough violins. So my teacher, Sister Pauline, said, you'll get lots more work playing, you know, you'll have lots more experience. So I started with a viola, and our school had instruments that you could borrow, which was good and a good system, because they're expensive to buy, and if a child gives up, it's, you know, that's not such a great outcome. But, yeah, so I did love the viola, and then I was given that violin by an elderly lady who was a photographer in Queanbeyan, and she'd moved up to the North Coast. And she herself was a very interesting person, but that's probably another story. So thank you very much for those kind words too. The sort of music I play is more that kind of way now. I was classically trained, but I do play lots more traditional music, and when I've travelled, I've met people, and so that's the kind of music I play now.
With both Calthorpes and Mugga Mugga, the radio was such an important and integral part of life there. How have you incorporated the music from that into the work that you're doing on the project?
Yes. The outcomes of the report are to combine... Each home will have a sound world, as I'm calling it, which is a collection of the music. It will be quite a small one, but it can be used online or in the house, but also there will be a written report which does make specific reference to the importance of, pardon me, the radio and the gramophone, because, you just can't underestimate the influence of those forces. This book that I was talking about, Sounds of Modern History, is absolutely fascinating, and I highly recommend it. Although it's scholarly, it's very accessible, but it talks about the revolution of technology from 1850 to 1950, where sound devices really changed the way people listened. And it began a very gradual but relentless process of people more consuming music, perhaps, than performing. And there were some deliberate political agendas behind that, which are very interesting. And but the research that I've done and the people I've worked with, the radio was a really positive thing. People learned things by ear. And what was more important of all was the fact that they learned what was current and what was popular and relevant to their community. So in a way, the radio has a very firm place in folk music, if you like, yeah, and certainly popular culture. People with musical abilities would pick up tunes very easily. So I certainly am and making reference to that. Yeah, thank you.
Just wondering, do you make any mention at all of adjunct types of musical instruments that were really popular, perhaps more in the bush, things like playing spoons and the old big drums with the bottle tops and things like that? Do they come into this project at all?
They do. No, they do, because I have a long history with bush music and playing in wool sheds and that kind of thing. And they were very important. And yes, indeed. What I will draw on is the interviews that I did for the doctoral research and interviews I've done over a long period of time with people who played in those bands. And you would be surprised how far the piano went, and I would class it absolutely as a bush instrument. There are some very interesting records of Mary Braidwood Moll, who took her piano out into the Brindabellas on a dray, and it was totally bashed around and it suffered from the damp, but she determinedly had it unpacked, sat down and played it, regardless of the fact it would have sounded very much like that piano of Sylvia Curley's at the time. For women, it was so important to have that piano because it was a kind of a talisman of culture. But the physicality of playing a piano is very, very comforting, I think. I dream about pianos. Does anybody else dream about pianos?
Someone who was self-taught. Seems incredible to me that someone could teach themselves to play something like a violin. Was that very common?
I think it was. And when you think about it, people had an awful lot of time. If you were a shepherd and you were out sitting watching sheep, and also it's very interesting trying to gain a sense of that community that the Duntroon homestead fostered. Originally, the first generation of shepherds were all Gaelic-speaking. It was an extraordinary, must have been, I don't know, it must have been an extraordinary sort of sound walking around it to hear nothing but Gaelic spoken. And presumably those shepherds were imported because they were people that the laird, Campbell, thought he could trust, that he understood their culture and they understood a system of hierarchy, which would work. So when we say self-taught, he would have learned by example, he would have observed people, but he wouldn't have gone to a formal class as we would learn music now. I think he would have had very eagle eyes and watched whoever he could come in contact with. There would have been fiddle players around the district. And so building on that visual knowledge, he and being a bush handyman, I think he applied all those skills, and he must have had a very good musical ear and just worked it out. I'm sure his style would have been quite unique and perhaps, you know, not in a classical sense, but who knows? I mean, he would have worked out what was comfortable and what enabled him to play that sort of strong rhythm that you needed for dance music. Yeah.
But you said, does anybody dream of pianos? I've just been to visit my 96-year-old sister. She dreams of pianos. She loved the piano. She always wanted to touch a piano if she saw one. And now, in this nursing home, she reads sheet music. She just has very complicated music and very simple music, but she says, I can hear it in my brain. And this is her reading matter the entire time. Our house was full of music, and she was particular. She was the one who really provided it.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a really lovely reminder that music exists in just so many ways, and we hold it so deeply in our memories and in our physical being. You know, it's funny, little things that will trigger a musical recollection, which will then connect you to a memory that's often a very powerful memory and usually positive. And to be able to read music in that way is such a gift, to be able to draw out the essence. Mm.
We are running out of time, and I'd urge you to continue your questions of Jennifer down in the Friends Lounge. But, Jennifer, thank you so much. That was such a wonderful presentation. And I can see so many applications to how music like that can really bring to life story and history. And we have a range of apps now at the museum that people use as they look at objects, and I can see that music would be, of the kind of work that you're doing, would really bring stories to life in a major way. Can you please join me again in thanking Dr. Jennifer Ball?
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.